The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com. I didn't go to college, but boy, I sure like talking to people who have made their career of being in college and are talking about education and keeping us up on what is going on there. And I find myself recovering from a lot of my public school education over the years, which is why one of the larger minds that I bring on the program every now and then, not nearly enough, but I'm glad to have him back. He's Professor John M. Ellis, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of German Literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And he's taught at universities in England, Wales, and Canada before joining UCSC in 1966, serving as Dean of the Graduate Division 77 to 86. He's written numerous books, including Literature Lost. And one of his more recent ones that I talked to him about, I think about a year or two ago was the last time we talked about this, Professor, The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, The Damage It Does, and What Can Be Done. Welcome back to the program. Good to have you on, sir.
Well, thanks so much for having me again.
Yes, and I've always enjoyed our conversations because you have been on the front line of the education revolution, the revolution in the academy, so to speak. And I know you haven't had a chance to watch President Trump's speech, the address to Congress last night. I did, and I was glad to hear him when he was talking about we're going to get rid of these destructive ideologies, we're going to get rid of the transgender policies, et cetera, et cetera. And he declared at the end of it words to the effect of woke is gone, this is gone, and pretty much saying that this was all going to be over and was all over. And I said, I like that. I like that sentiment. I really do. And I appreciate his confidence. My concern, though, is I've talked with you several times about what's really going on in public education. And I'm concerned that this is much more embedded in the DNA of the educational establishment than even President Trump may know. And what are your thoughts on this, please?
Well, like you, I really like the fact that President Trump is going after DEI and outlawing it, and what he's telling universities is if you have DEI officers, you're going to get no federal funds. And I like that enormously. And I like his decisiveness and the fact that, if he sees a way to correct these, very damaging conditions in the universities, he'll take it. But I like you, I have the feeling that there's something there that'll need much more than banning DEI and threatening the loss of funds if people keep on going with DEI.
I mean, it's certainly a good first step, but
it's a good first step. Yeah. But, I mean, what we have is a political monopoly on the campuses. In other words, it's virtually 100%. I mean, not quite 100%. There are a few conservative scholars left, but they're being harassed into early retirement. I've just written a piece on one of those. Professor Amy Wax, University of Pennsylvania, is being harassed by a liberal colleague. She's a wonderful writer, a splendid academic, but she's conservative, so they've gone after John Eastman, Chapman. They've gone after half a dozen people I know in California. So basically, it is a monopoly now. I mean, it's a left-wing monopoly. And the problem with left-wing monopolies is they're bound to go crazy sooner or later. I mean, I'm a great fan of John Stuart Mill. And John Stuart Mill said a lot of great things, but the one I like best is, let me read it out to you. John Stuart Mill said, a party of order or stability, a party of progress or reform, obviously, in other words, right, a party and a left party, are both necessary elements of a healthy state of political life. It is in a great measure the opposition of the other that keep each of them within the limits of reason and sanity. Now, in other words, I mean, John Stuart Mill is a very elegant, precise writer. He doesn't use inflammatory language easily. But when he tells you that if you have a monopoly party and the other party is squeezed out, when he tells you that's the recipe for insanity, you better listen, and I think that that's what's going on the campuses. I mean, you have a you have a party monopoly on those campuses. And as John Stuart Mill says, whenever you have a monopoly that's squeezed out the other party, what you have is you've gotten rid of the only thing that keeps that party healthy and sane. And what's going on the campuses right now is because we have a monopoly, a political monopoly, the campuses are crazy. I mean, and so they're the source of wokeness. There are all these dopey ideas, that'll continue. I mean, I think Trump is a very resourceful man, and I hope that what he'll do is to try to encourage states, state governments, state legislatures, to tell their state universities that this monopoly has got to stop, has got to end now, or there's no funding. Now, that will do more than just banning DEI. What it'll tell the professoriate of these states, state universities and colleges, that if they continue with this monopoly, you know, only left people can become professors. That's the philosophy on those campuses. So what they need to be told by the people who provide the money, which is the legislature and the governor, is that if you continue this political monopoly, we'll cut off your money. We'll cut off your funding. And I hope...
So this goes beyond, hey, we're going to cut off your federal funding over DEI and various other woke institutions or woke ideology here on this. And yet, you know, I look at State of Oregon, Oregon State University system, is once again that same kind of monopoly that you talked about, Professor Ellis. And it is now a number of years ago, it was made into a state agency. So it is actually able to be even more powerful than a typical state university system because it negotiates and uses its bully pulpit in government-to-government relationships, even with our cities and our counties. Without this, it's almost like in the enforcement arm of the ideology of the state legislature.
The strides they've made in insinuating themselves just everywhere. I mean, the woke professors, the woke ideology, they've quietly infiltrated and gotten control of professional associations, like, you know, the American Bar Association and the
American Planning Association isn't a big one, too.
That sort of stuff, foundations, NGOs, advocacy groups, corporate offices, editorial boards, unions, government departments, even churches. I mean, the woke left has quietly infiltrated everywhere. Now, they know that the public is heavily against them. In fact, I would say that the common sense of the public is something that the woke ideology can't tolerate because it kills them. I mean, common sense of the public is just sort of like daylight is to a vampire. You know, it kills it off straight away.
Yeah, you turn the lights on and the roaches scatter, right? In the kitchen.
Right. So they got to do it. They've got to do it behind closed doors. And boy, do they do it behind closed doors. I mean, they take over all these organizations quietly and against what the public wants. I mean, heavily against what the public wants. So what you got to do is stop the thing at the source. The political monopoly on the campus has got to be broken up. And until we do that, I mean, I welcome everything Trump is doing. I applaud it. I'm very encouraged by it. He's the only one that's made a determined attempt to change things. But until he takes aim at the political monopoly on the campuses, I'm afraid nothing fundamental is going to change.
I was concerned about that, too. And once again, I'm talking with Professor John Ellis. And in his excellent book, which I last spoke to you a little while ago, was the breakdown of higher education, how it happened, the damage it does. And the thing is, you were there you had a front row seat to this in the UC, in the UC Santa Barbara system since 1966, a lot of years, and you saw it. Was it just, how did it creep in? Was it something which just came in with the 1968 or post-Summer of Love kind of thing? or do you think there was something deeper? Because it was really almost the beginning of critical theory. Just the critical theory seemed to be a start of it. I don't know if I'm right about that or not.
Yeah. Well, look, when I started off in 66 at UC, I actually started off academic teaching in 1959. I'm that old.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very healthy. I mean, the academic world, the university world, was a very rational place, filled with very bright, very energetic people. A lot of them had served in the Second World War. I mean, in other words, most of the people who taught me had been in the intelligence operations, because they were Germanists, so they were employed in counter-espionage and so on.
Oh, that's right, yeah, because that was your professor of German literature. Okay, now
yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense, sure.
So basically, I was surrounded by real adults. I mean, that was people who'd seen something of life. Now, I noticed about 1975, all of a sudden, there were some younger professors talking nonsense. I mean, sort of silly ideas like defunding the police, and that sort of stuff.
It was that long ago. In other words, it was back that far, 50 years.
And I realized straight away that the one thing that was different about those people was that they had gone from high school straight into undergraduate work at college, then graduate studies, then assistant professor in the university. In other words, they'd never seen the real world. And so the wonderful, vibrant university world with real experienced people who'd been in the Second World War was giving way to these younger people that had never seen anything of the business world or the world of ordinary people. And it just got worse and worse. And then, of course, there was the fact that the Students for a Democratic Society, which is a Marxist group, in 1962 said that they couldn't get power electorally, they couldn't win elections, but they could take over the academic world, they could take over the universities and use them as a way of influencing the electorate. Well, when I read that, I sort of laughed because it seemed so. It was 1962. It seemed so extravagant. I thought, they couldn't possibly take over the whole university world, but they actually did. They did it very slowly and methodically. They've slowly raised their numbers. I mean, back in about 1969, believe it or not, there were three left professors for every two right-wing professors.
Relatively balanced, especially when compared to today, right?
Yeah. So basically that meant a pretty good conversation, a pretty good debate between the two. In other words, going back to John Stuart Mill, each one of each side kept the other from stupidity. I mean, they acted as a corrective. So it was a healthy debate. Now, by the time you got to about the year 2000, 30 years later, the left outnumbered the right 5-1. Now, when you get to 5-1, you've got control. And then the numbers go up sharply after that. So within 5 years, you went from 5-1 to 8-1. It's currently about 15-1, but it's still rising. So you do have this monopoly. And, you cannot have a university with a faculty that has a left-wing monopoly. It just won't work. I mean, the people concerned are going to get dumb very rapidly because they never hear an opinion other than their own. And if you don't use your brain to argue with the other side, to oppose the other side's arguments, if you don't use your brain that way, it gets lazy and stupid. And that's
flaccid. Flaccid intellectually, in other words.
That's where we are right now. The universities, instead of being places of intellectual excellence, are places of intellectual stupidity. I mean, I'm sorry to have to say that, but I'd rather have the ordinary, the common sense of the ordinary person on the street who's not gone to the university, I'd rather have that than a university professor right now.
Professor, if you can hang on, do you have a few more minutes here? I know we talked about 15.
Yes.
I think you're one of those guys that takes a little more than 15 sometimes because I just enjoy picking your brain on this here. And
well, I probably talk too much, too.
Well, this is a talk show. Talking too much is okay. You know, it's all right. We'll be right back with you. And if you had a question for Professor John M. Ellis once again, and just an amazing brain, The Breakdown of Higher Education is his book, and we talked with him about that a couple of years ago, but we're focusing on President Trump's effort to get rid of the woke ideology in education, both lower and higher education. 770-5633. We'll be right back with the professor next.
Freddy's Diner has lots.
On News Talk 106.3 KMED.
You're hearing The Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Professor John M. Ellis with me, and we're talking about the effort to root the woke ideology, you just grab it by the roots and get it out of the system. President Trump said in the speech last night that it's just, it's done, it's over. And I wish that were true. I think there's going to be a little more work involved in this. And Professor, before we go to the phones, people did want to weigh in on some of this. You had talked about how when the academy becomes so politically one-sided that it gets stupid and gets crazy. And I would certainly agree with you when I look at the academy today. Now, we're looking at a left-wing monopoly. Have we ever had a right-wing monopoly within the university system? And what did that do? What were the types of intellectual sclerosis, I guess, that came from that? Any examples?
No, not in the English-speaking world. Well, I mean, you have to go back a long way to the point where universities were basically training grounds for priests. I mean, go back to Oxford and Cambridge, you know, back in 500 years ago. I mean, then they were conservative institutions because they were training grounds for people going into the church. But in the modern world, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the last couple of hundred years, that certainly wasn't the case. Now, you know, I've talked about the fact that the Second World War produced an academic world from about 1945 to about 1970 that was intellectually first rate. Now, you know,
part of that may have been because the people that were in that system had seen war and deprivation.
That's right.
They knew reality.
That's right. Now, let me tell you a story. I mean, when I remember telling my father that I was going to make a career out of university teaching, and he was very disappointed. And he said to me, but he was thinking of pre-war. Now, pre-Second World War, that was when his opinions were formed of the university world. He said to me, professors are all cranks and crackpots. Now, I didn't realize that. I thought he was dead wrong at the time, because what I knew, the academic world I knew about 1950 or 60, was first rate. People were very smart people. But I'm thinking it over since then, I realized that what he put his finger on was the same thing that I saw in 1975 and on, the lack of common sense of ordinary people. And so what he was seeing in 1930 was something that was a little bit in the direction of what we live with now. I mean, people, professors were cranks and crackpots. In other words, they lacked the common sense of ordinary people. And I think that so the Second World War era, you know, I mean, the era of the university is about 1945 to 1975. That was the anomaly, probably. I mean, but pre-Second World War, you had in the London School of Economics, you had Harold Lasky was the most powerful figure, and he was a Marxist, and he was the head of the economics department at a major university in England, and he was a flat-out Marxist. So, you know, I worry about the fact that as long as we have people going from high school to undergraduate to graduate work and straight into the classroom to teach at college without any intervening experience in the real world, I worry that we're always going to be subject to this problem of professors lacking common sense.
And the woke ideology then. So would you suggest that we change the culture and maybe we work for a few years and get real world experience and then go to the university? Would that be better or healthier?
It would be much, much better. I'm not sure how you can do it. That's the problem. I mean, you can't just say to people, well, look, go and work in business for 5 years, then come back because you'll be a better professor. Now, that would be true, but I'm not sure you could ever have a system where you could get people to do that. You know, people want to get on with their career, and if they choose a career in higher education, they want to get to it and, you know, begin on it as quickly as they can. So I think this may be a permanent weakness of the university world we're always going to have to struggle with.
Professor John Allis with me, and we have Wild Sam and Steve. Steve, it's great to have you here. You have a question or comment for the professor. Go ahead.
Yeah, yes, I graduated from high school in 1965 and college in 1969, and in my last year of college, I had to take a philosophy class, and I come to the class right after working a shift, a cleanup shift in a plywood mill, and I didn't have time to change clothes, so I came pretty, you know, dirty, and I'd blown off myself, but I'm sure I didn't look very good. The professor was having his talk about who we were, and he when he came to me, he said, "You look like a bum," and I said, "Well, I just got off work." And he goes, "Work? Why would you be working?" And I said, "To pay your salary." And things went kind of downhill from there. But the underlying thing was, this was the transition when the student loan program first came out. And so they were making it so easy to get money to go to college. And that ended up raising the salaries of college professors. So I wonder what the professor would think about the student loan program being the underlying problem, an underlying problem.
That's a great point. What would you say about that, Professor? Go ahead.
Well, you know, here's the problem, that everyone would like to have the benefit of a great university education. But the problem is that there aren't enough really bright people to teach college to make that happen. I mean, if you have 100% of the population getting into college, you need a huge number of professors. Then there aren't that many people who are good enough to do the job. So you get to a point where if you make it too easy to get to college, you're bound to degrade the quality. And I think that's what's happened, basically. I mean,
Of course, that's also a part of DEI. Everything becomes about equity rather than merit, right?
That's right. I think it might be better for a lot of people to just simply start work, you know, at a career at age 18 and not bother with college, which I think there's a segment of the population that can benefit from that kind of education, and it's great for them, and I think we're better off as a society for that. But I think that if you raise the numbers too much, then you've got to raise the numbers of college professors to teach them. And there aren't that many people who are good enough to do that. And I think my own feeling is that what you do, if you raise the numbers too much, you increase the proportion of second-rate to first-rate professors. And at the moment, the ratio of second rate people are not really good enough for the job, not smart enough for the job. The proportion of those people to the first rate people is about, you know, maybe 9-1, and once it goes above 1-1, you have the not very smart people in the majority, and that's very, very bad for the situation.
Professor John Allis with me. I believe we have Ed here. Hello, Ed. How are you?
Good morning, Bill, and I think it's great you're having this conversation. I'm trying to formulate it into a question, but basically it's a question of if he's understanding of it or knows of it. But in 2003, the state of Oregon made the university a state agency.
Yes, I mentioned that early in our talk with him. You know about that,
right? Mm-hmm. And but the lineage of that has to be put forth is that they did that by giving the state agency status to it for the dispute resolution commission, and at that point they entered the legal system, and that's a methodology that they use with the National Policy Consensus Center, all of these things And then they branched out to the University Network of Collaborative Governance because that state agency designation allowed that university system to collaborate and cooperate with every other international, federal, and state agency in the country.
So the university system ends up being used as the virus vector. Is that kind of what you're getting at here?
Well, it's, the virus vector is so much more magnified by this because to this day, the only other state that I researched that I know that this has happened in is Massachusetts, which is extremely a socialist state, you know, with these types of things. But it's not as active as this part of it is in controlling. And I look at what they've done to our election system, what they've done to every aspect of it, allowing out-of-state students to vote in our elections, all of these things combined. We have a real problem, you know, along with everything that he just talked about. And this is one of the key factors in dismantling this intrusion into our lives.
How would you, and thank you for the call there, Ed. Yeah, so the California university system is not a state agency, technically, so it doesn't have the power that the Oregon one does here, Professor, if I recall.
Yeah, well, I take it this is really a question of how much supervision the universities have in Oregon. It sounds to me as though that particular framework almost takes away any supervision of the state.
Kind of a force unto itself, you know, is what it has turned into.
That's very, very dangerous to give the universities that much power and to take away any kind of corrective framework. Because at the moment, I mean, look, for example, I mean, people complain about how kids in elementary schools and high schools are doing very badly.
And by the way, Oregon students are considered last in the nation or close to it, number 50 overall.
Right. So, now, people complain about that, but where do teachers get trained? Well, the teachers get trained on university campuses in the Department of Education. People complain about the fact that journalists are all biased in favor of the left. Well, where do journalists get trained? They get trained on university campuses and so on. I mean, the university campuses train lawyers. They train architects. They train doctors. So, I mean, when the Students for a Democratic Society in 1962 said that their path forward was not by elections but by taking over the university campuses, I you know, at the time I thought, well, that's okay. So
yeah, you laughed at them then, right? You laughed at them, probably.
I laughed at it, yeah. But what I didn't realize, they weren't just talking about influencing students in their classrooms. I mean, you know, in other words, bachelor's degrees, kids going out infected with socialist ideas. They knew that if they had the universities, they had the training of teachers, they had the training of lawyers, they had the training of journalists, they had the training of doctors. I mean, the massive power was put in the hands of the left by doing this. And I must confess that at the time, 1962, I did not see the extent of that danger. So anyway, to go back to the Oregon situation, if in addition to that, you make them self-sufficient, you make them, you give them a situation where they're not subject to any control by anybody else, then you really have trouble.
As far as reform, and I'll give you the final word here in the final a few minutes of this here. And can the academy that we have in the United States right now, can all of this that we've been talking about, can it be reformed within the system, or must it be killed?
It could. I think it could. But I'll tell you, there's one huge barrier, which is, so many people say you'll never be able to reform the universities. And the problem is, I think that's the thing that's most in our way. I mean, in fact, there's plenty of scope for reform. I mean, state universities are funded by legislatures and governors in each state. Now, you know, it's perfectly simple to recognize that a political monopoly in universities destroys them. It's simple to prove it. It's simple to explain why it must happen. As John Stuart Mill explained it already years ago. Now, How difficult would it be for a legislature to say to their state universities, look, political monopoly is suicide for a university. It cannot work. Come up with a plan to stop it, to break it up, or we'll stop your funding. It's a very simple thing to do. I mean, any state university could do it. But even in red states, legislators are scared of doing it because the universities have had such prestige throughout history. You know, I mean, the prestige of a place like Harvard the tremendously sort of powerful idea in people's minds that these are wonderful institutions. But the state universities don't have quite that much prestige, but they still are able to intimidate legislatures who are not, they're just not psychologically up to the task of saying to their state universities, reform yourself, you know, cut out this political monopoly, which is so destructive, or we cut your funding.
That's the kind of funding that will get their attention more so than President Trump's, we're going to cut the federal funding at this point in time.
I think so. I think so, because state funding, you know, strikes at the base. I mean, honestly, it's not that hard to do, except that there are people who think that it can't be done. And there's no reason why to think that it can't be done. It can be done. Red states everywhere have...
Well, it would be hard to do, but the hard thing to do is what needs to be done, and the hard thing is worth it. We do it.
Yeah.
You know? I'm paraphrasing almost a Kennedy-esque kind of state. I think he did a quote like, we go to the moon because it's hard or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. It's only hard because they think it's hard. It's not really hard.
But it does take spine, and I think that is is part of it. All right.
Yes.
Professor, thank you so much for your thoughts, and I hope to have you back, and I'll link to your latest article. By the way, did that one get in the Washington Post right now? What are you trying to get into the Post?
I sent it to the Washington Post. I'm sure, I think it's unlikely that it'll take it. I just wanted to test out whether the new regime of the Washington Post, which is supposed to be now... bipartisan. In other words, Jeff Bezos has announced that he's going to make the opinion page of the Washington Post open to both points of view, left and right. Now, so I just want to test out: is that going to be the case?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll have you back. We'll find out if Bezos is truly serious. We'll see.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Professor. Good talk as always. Be well.
Well, thanks for having me again. Thanks so much.
All right. Professor John Ellis. Professor John Ellis. And like I said, a book, I consider his book a must read. And we talked about it when he first brought it out. And it's still worthwhile. The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, The Damage It Does, and What Can Be Done. And he talked about what can be done. This is the Bill Meyer Show.
You're worried because your home has been on the market with no success. An expired listing can be frustrating, but it doesn't have to be the end of your journey. Hey, it's Lars. What you need is the right real estate agent. And in the Medford area, that would be only my friend Jared Hokanson of Hokanson Realty. Jared specializes in turning things around so he can get your property sold. It's not that there's something wrong with your house. You just need expert marketing and somebody who knows how to properly price your home. Jared Hokanson's more than 25 years' experience in leadership, sales, management, and training are all part of a proven track record, which combined to make him Medford's top and go-to industry expert. There's been a lot of uncertainty in the real estate world, but through it all, Jared Hokanson remains the agent you can trust. I trust Jared. You should, too. 541-772-SOLD. That's 541-772-7653. Or reach out to Jared through his website, 541-772-SOLD.com.
The Best of Southern Oregon magazine is back for its third incredible season. As the region's premier showcase of excellence, this event celebrates the best of the best businesses and organizations as voted by you, our community. Nominations for the Best of Southern Oregon began on March 12th. Join us in honoring the outstanding talent, innovation, and dedication that make our region shine. The Best of Southern Oregon 2025 is proudly presented by Dusty's Transmissions and Bi-Coastal Media.
This hour of the Bill Meyer Show is sponsored by Fontana Roofing. For roofing, gutters, and sheet metal services, visit FontanaRoofingServices.com.
It's amazing. What's right under your floor can impact your whole house. musty smells, wall cracks, uneven floors, doors and windows that stick. These could all be your home sending you warning signs that there's a problem. But one simple call can be the answer to fixing everything under your home. For more than a decade, Terra Firma has been our area's number one solution for better basements, foundations, and crawl spaces. So why waste another day worrying? Make an investment in a more healthy, more valuable home. Call Terra Firma today.
American Industrial Door has security and storm shutters and mesh for commercial and residential applications. These shutters protect storefronts, windows, retail counters, product cases, whatever needs instant protection against burglary, vandalism, and severe weather. With a touch of a button, you can secure an entry point or space with style and color. American Industrial Door has affordable scissor gates too. See all the security shutter options at American Industrial Door on Union Avenue in Grants Pass and on Crater Lake Avenue north of Violets Road.
Wipeout Hunger is over. Thank you to everyone who participated in our Wipeout Hunger campaign at Kelly's Automotive Service. We're so grateful for your generosity, and we hope that you're seeing better with your new wiper blades. But now we want to wipe out the rodents that are living underneath the hood of your car, causing wiring issues and other expensive repairs. Call us or go online at kellysautomotive.com and make an appointment for installation of our ultrasonic rodent repeller for just $197. Kelly's Automotive Service will service your vehicle, but take care of you.
This is News Talk 106.3 KMED, and you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
10 before 9, 770-5633. Angie's here. Angie, you're feeding the ducks. Hopefully we can get through with me and feed the ducks okay. But tell me about your experience when you were coming back home from Australia, please.
Yeah, I was on a flight, 11-hour flight from Fiji, and I had this student guy that had got a scholarship from California to Australia, and he's been there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he very nice guy, very handsome and everything, but he was hugging a teddy bear the whole way home.
You're joking, right?
No. And he was smart. And I said, he was hugging a teddy bear the whole way home on the flight.
Huh. And so, now, is this someone that was just emotional?
No. I had a conversation with him. He was very smart and a student. And I said, what's with the teddy bear? And he says, this is my, companion or whatever. Now, he wasn't dopey, no. He wasn't, I thought he was a bit funny, but he wasn't. He was very smart to talk to, but he was hugging this teddy bear the whole way home.
So, a bit emotionally fragile, from the sounds of it, then. Huh?
Well, he was going home to the fires, he felt he needs comfort or something. So,
all right.
The other experience I have of a student is when I was sitting at a Thanksgiving dinner, I had this very smart guy across the way from me, and I asked him what he was going to do, and did he think of going into business? And he said he had never discussed that with his professor. And I said, do you need to discuss everything with your professor? Well, but the professor never brought it up in a conversation.
But isn't that interesting, though, what influence?
That's what I'm trying to point out here.
Yeah,
these are so influenced by the people that they have around them.
Yeah,
and they're frightened. They're all frightened about life.
And frightened people are very easy to control too, I would dare say.
Absolutely. Hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much. By the way, how are your ducks? How many ducks do you have?
I have about 30 at the moment, but 25 of them are from my freezer for meat.
Oh, good. You do that, because I love duck. I absolutely love
it. Okay.
It's one of my favorite. Do you sell them, or what do you do?
I haven't got any registration, but I will definitely give you one.
Oh, don't want that. I'm not plumbing for it.
Okay.
I want to take care of it.
No,
it's just
no,
that.
No, it's a gift. I get a gift. I'll give you a gift, okay?
Oh, Angie, you didn't have to do that. That's very kind of you. I just thought that I didn't know if they were pets. I didn't know if they were pets or they were practical animals. That's what I wasn't sure.
Can you butcher a duck yourself?
Can I do it? I've never done that. No, but I.
Okay. All right then. Well, I'll do it for you.
Okay? You see, you're a practical woman. It's what I like about you. Okay.
There was five of us in my family, and four of them were sent to university, and I was the only one that had a business and ran a business, and I ended up being a lot more wealthier than all of the rest of my family, and I'm dyslexic. So I'm a dope as well.
Oh, no, you're not a dope. As a matter of fact, my wife is dyslexic. She has that too.
She is. Okay.
And the thing is, though, I appreciate that because dyslexics have an interesting way. They'll catch patterns and see things that someone like me who doesn't have dyslexia doesn't see. And I really appreciate them. I really do. Appreciate the call. Good hearing from you. It's great. Irish Angie. It's 8:55. Let me grab another call here. Good morning. Hi.
Joel, calling in from the Iron Gate.
Hi, Joel.
Hey, the river is ripping. It went down a little bit, but it was like 4 feet higher for 2 days.
Wow.
And yeah. And
what does it look like if you were going to say, you know, I'm just wondering how clean the, you know, has the river been? Because there's been some questions people have asked me about what does it look like ever since the blowing of the dam. And I remember when I had the water tested by Clouser, and it was just miserable, miserable water quality. Has that improved any?
Well, it's running right now. Like, I don't know what they dumped in the river, but I remember talking about a month ago to one of the downstairs stations, to Chevron, our only store. I'm sorry. Hey, guys, what'd you do with all the dirt? Well, we pushed half of it into the river.
Mm-hmm.
Like, see, and I got witnesses to that, but it's just like, I thought that will ever be
a- Well, you know, you can pollute the river and push the dirt piles in as long as you, you know, are associated with the far left wing environmentalist state governments, which makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Dollars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, well, be well. Thanks for the report from the Iron Gate in the Klamath, okay? 8:56. Good people there. 8:58. Brother Brad's here. Hey, Brad, you were asking about the hissy fit protest downtown yesterday. Go ahead.
Yeah, I drove by, and you know we all have a right to protest.
It's sure.
Part of our freedom of speech, but it just seems like the only people that do that stuff are college students from Ashland or retirees from Ashland, and what they got nothing better to do with their time apparently.
Yeah, well, and like I say, God bless them, I guess. But my concern is that what was interesting is that I commented on this, and someone said, "Oh gosh, you know, you're like a little Alex Jones in training or something like that." Because I said, "Well, essentially, what they're protesting when it comes to the Ukraine war, they're protesting the elimination of the neoliberal order, which has corruptly been controlling things for a long time here, Brad, in which you write hot checks to the NGOs, and the NGOs set out there and put progressive policies in place in governments all around the world. I think that's coming to an end, and yeah, they're not real happy, okay? I think we'll have to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, kind of out of time, but I'll see you then. All right.
Hey, thanks, buddy.
All right, see you, buddy. The email, bill@billmeyershow.com. Tomorrow we'll have a good time. It'll be Conspiracy Theory Thursday. See you then.
Southern Oregon's place to talk. KMED and KMED HD1 Eagle Point, Medford, a bi-coastal media station.
It's 9 o'clock at KMED.